a paleo nerd. I'm a paleo nerd. Don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.
Hey, Ray.
David. Good to see you, man.
How's it going? We're recording this late May, almost June.
Yeah, and in 2021, and
oh, is that the year?
That is the year, I think. I do kind of lose track. This.
You just said you did some sort of a outreach with kids and art yesterday. That sounded pretty cool. Paleo art?
Actually, families joined me. I drew prehistoric salmon. I drew giant spike-toothed salmon, and we've talked about spike-toothed salmon. I drew this because the University of Oregon, the Museum of Natural and Cultural History there, they have the best specimens in the world there. They've got the holotype there, which is the first one ever discovered. They got
some
other ones.
And so the spike tooth is called, what, Oncorhynchus, what, big mouthy, big toothy, smilodon?
Big spicus. It is Oncorhynchus rastrosus.
Rastrosus. And what does rastrosus mean?
Rastrosus means, it refers to the gill rakers. But
actually,
one of the things I learned last night, so it was the first time they discovered it, they thought they were sabers, right? And then they
because
discovered.
They thought they were pointing down. But
right.
Right.
But then there were some that were in private collections, and then recently they found others that went into a public collection showing this, their spikes. They go sideways.
Right.
But when they first found it, they named it Smilodon ichthys, and they put it in a new genus, and they compared it to a saber tooth.
Right.
Well, now
right.
I learned that that name is in brackets. So it is actually officially Oncorhynchus, in brackets, Smilodon ichthys, rastrosus. But those are the brackets, the parentheses of shame. So that's what
okay.
that's what.
But yeah,
Davis,
I think our guest Jerry Smith, when we talked to him a few weeks back,
yeah, he talked about that. But yeah, I thought it's the brackets of shame. So
yeah,
the name is no longer valid.
The brackets of misnaming, the brackets of shame by misnaming something, right?
That almost rhymes. Yeah, man, it'd be a song. Well, anyways, I drew with like 100 kids. Everybody tuned in. We had a scientist on. Ed was Davis from the University of Oregon was there, and it was really cool to have a scientist correcting me and adding to the dialogue. And back and forth we went.
Is that viewable online? Can we see that?
Yeah, actually, they taped it, and it'll be online.
Great.
So yeah.
Great. So we'll have the link to that in
we
this
can
episode.
Have that. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, good on you for teaching kids art and paleo art.
Yeah. We, kids and adults, kids of all ages.
Which, by the way, I'm pretty sure we're going to have a art page on our website where listeners can submit their artwork, and we'll probably have contests and who knows, yearly annual contests, but it would be great to share art from all ages, you know, professional, amateur, everything, all paleo art is awesome. So
look
out for that soon on paleonerds.com.
We're finding out that there's actually a lot of kids listening to the show, which is very cool.
Yeah, it is
cool. And all the kids at heart.
That's right. And I occasionally bleep out when you swear.
I'm sorry, I did.
Well, it's bleeped.
Yeah, bleep. What's going on today, man?
So today, we are back at my comfort museum, which is the La Brea Tar Pits.
And we are talking about dogs today, man. Dogs, everybody's, you know, man's best friend.
That's right. Well, not just dogs, but fossil mammalian carnivores, because our guest is an expert on just that.
On the carnivora.
Carnivora. How do you say it?
Carnivora, I think, actually is the carnivora.
We'll
you could say carnivora, but I think she's going to say carnivora.
All right.
Myrene Balisi. And she is she's a postdoctoral research fellow. She's actually doing some exciting stuff with all those poor creatures that have gotten stuck in the tar seeps low these 40,000 years.
Yeah.
And they continue to do so to this day.
Yeah. Poor cats and dogs and birds and skunks and all the mammals that live, badgers and possums, all the mammals that live around Los Angeles today.
Those trash pandas known as raccoons.
That's
they're
right.
in there too.
I don't know if there's any raccoons really in
La
Brea.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, recent ones, like from the last 20 years.
You know, I thought you were doing your homework on our guest. You know, she's been working on raccoons in the past. And
no, I'm talking about raccoons from today, from this time period.
What do you? LA is full of raccoons and coyotes. Man, it's full of them.
Wow. Okay. Well, listen. We'll ask her about the current victims of La Brea.
All right. Well, shall we call her up?
Sure. Let's do it.
Hey, David Strassman, meet Myrene Balisi, postdoctoral research fellow at the La Brea Tar Pits and Museum and University of California, Merced. Myrene, thank you so much for joining us. I've been following your work, and it's a real honor to have you here. And meet Dave.
Hey. Hi, Myrene. So nice to meet you. You know, the La Brea Tar Pits is my comfort museum.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. And it's really great to meet you both. My Zoom background right now. So I wish I were at the Tar Pits at the moment. Instead, I am at home because we still do have these COVID restrictions. But I do have on my Zoom background our direwolf wall, which may be a familiar sight to some of you and certainly to David, I would expect.
So yes, I've seen that a million times, wondering how many skulls are there, something like 70 or 80 or something like that?
No. There are a few hundred, right? 400 or something?
Exactly. On this wall
what?
Alone.
Really?
There are 400, yeah.
Of the 4,000 you have? Something like
of
that?
Of the 4,000 and counting that we have.
And what is direwolf? That's Canis diris?
That's a fantastic question because it was Canis diris, but actually there was work that came out very recently, just earlier this year, that puts into, so this work is based on ancient DNA, and so it seems that it's no longer Canis, rather it's Anocyon diris, so it's A-E-N-O-C-Y-O-N, is the new genus name that has been proposed by this paper.
Has that been accepted by all the direwolf community?
I'm fine with it.
Okay.
I think it makes sense, and from the genetic genomic relationships aspect, and in terms of behavior, I mean, I don't think it really changes our idea of how direwolves used to behave or how they used to hunt. You know, they still look like wolves and presumably hunted like the great wolves that we have today.
Yeah, but they existed before humans ever named them. So naming is for us, not for them. We're going to get into your background in a second, but staying on the direwolf, what is the most recent and earliest, not earliest, but the latest that a direwolf lived in Southern California that walked around the La Brea area? What's the latest? 11,000 years ago?
Yeah, about 11,000 years ago. So there's a lot of radiocarbon dating that's being done recently by a team at the La Brea Tar Pits. And that was around the same time that
the megafauna.
Yes.
Exactly. All the megafauna, including saber-toothed cats also.
And there's always, you know, curiously, that's when humans really show up. But that's another debate. But actually,
we'll get into that later.
We'll get into that. But Dave, you have a very important question.
Very important question. And I don't know if anybody's ever asked you this, Myrene. Are you a paleo nerd?
I am a paleo nerd. I would hope so, considering you all invited me here.
Well, we're usually spot on. We can spot one of our fellow paleo nerds. And you have an unusual background, and how did the paleo nerddom start up? You were born in the Philippines and came to the U.S. at age 13, and I watched the Fossil Friday show with you, and you talked about National Geographic and your grandfather.
Wait, you were cleaning bones. You were cleaning La Brea bones in Berkeley, not knowing.
Well, let's get there. I want to let's back up, okay? Before we get to Berkeley, tell us a little bit about your background, if you don't mind.
Of course, yeah. So, yes, Ray, you're correct. I was born in the Philippines, and thank you so much for watching that Fossil
Friday.
Yeah,
it's a great show.
Where my parents are from, so I personally am from Manila, which is the capital of the Philippines. It's in about the central part of the North Island, the big island that we have. And my family's from the northern part of the Philippines, though, and it's called Cagayan. Mm-hmm. And around there is this cave that's called Calao Cave. So it's actually a series of these beautiful limestone caves, and some of them have early, you know, ancestral human fossils, and of course the fauna, the animals that were associated with them. But growing up, even having visited the caves as a child with my parents, I did not know that background, and I did not know about the international significance of these things, and you know, the Philippines is a very biodiverse. You know, it's a biodiversity hotspot. It's very lush. You know, people go there and talk about waterfalls and tropical forests. But I personally grew up in the capital. So it was a very urban environment that I grew up in. And it's only now as an adult, now we have Google Maps that enables, you know, us to zoom out from wherever we grew up and realize, oh, there was tropical forest right there.
Yeah.
So my grandpa was part of the, my entire family started moving over to the United States back in the 1970s. And my grandpa would send home to the Philippines, you know, National Geographic magazines. And whenever he went back to the Philippines, also, he would bring boxes of these magazines. And so National Geographic was, you know, it was just incredible. It was my first glimpse of, you know, natural history, biodiversity, paleontology, archaeology, and also photography. That was...
Just as we're talking now, I'm realizing that was kind of one of my first... I got dinosaur books, but my grandfather had an entire basement full of National Geographics. And I would go... They would lock me in the basement sometimes when I was a bad boy.
It's the gateway drug to all things natural.
I started out, and some of those images just seared into my brain. And so that would kind of set the fire for you. And you eventually moved to the United States, and you went to college, and you ended up going to Berkeley, where there were some bones in a certain tower. How did those bones get there in that tower?
So Berkeley has a museum of paleontology. So as an undergrad there, I had the opportunity to take this class on comparative vertebrate morphology. So for that class, it was taught by Tony Barnosky, a vertebrate paleontologist. Mm-hmm. And for a class project, he had us go to the bell tower. So the official name for this bell tower is the Campanile or Sather Tower.
The what? And, what?
The Campanile.
is that Italian or Spanish?
I think it is meant to be Italian. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So generally the bell tower, or Sather Tower, and the bells are at the top. So if you were, you know, there are tours, right? Campus tours. If you wanted to take the bell tower tour, then you would take an elevator up to the bells at the top. But little do most people know that the elevator takes you past all these floors with bones in them. So as far as I know, most, if not all of the bones are Tarpitz bones. There was no Tarpitz Museum yet. So the Tarpitz Museum opened in late 60s, early 70s. So a lot of the excavations down here were being led by paleontologists from elsewhere, including Berkeley.
I would think there'd be a lot of sharing of specimens all over the world or all over America.
Yeah. I think sharing also does happen. And so a lot of the fossils that Berkeley paleontologists excavated ended up coming back with them to the University of California Museum of Paleontology. And at that same time, that clock tower was in the process of being built. Because of that, the clock tower was one of the, or the bell tower was one of the, you know, places on campus that had room for all of these fossils. And so these fossils went in there.
So you ended up working on those bones, scrubbing those bones? Were there lots of dire wolf skulls and mammoths?
Or were they in a matrix or what? Was it just a...
Yeah, so actually they were not in matrix. And I did scrub bones, but not these ones. These were other bones that I ended up scrubbing.
Okay.
what I ended up doing with the Tarpitz material in the clock bell tower at Berkeley was our class project involved studying locomotion based on bones, and so we did this shape analysis of some ankle bones, if I remember correctly. And you know, this was a class project; it wasn't really publishable, but at least we didn't work on publishing it. It may have been.
What was the first fossil you touched or handled that, you know, was an aha moment?
We definitely handled direwolf. We definitely handled saber-toothed cat as well. So that is as much as I remember from back then. But it wasn't even the skulls. You know, I think that people are very, very aha inspired by skulls. But these were like ankle bones and other foot bones. But yeah, just knowing that this used to belong to an animal that is now extinct, and in the case of the saber tooth, an animal that we don't really have an exact analog for in modern day. Yeah, I think that was.
But somewhere in that tower, something clicked with you, and your path was set. But you were also a comparative literature major as well. But did you do?
What?
Yeah, Japanese.
Oh, that's right, Japanese and Russian.
Yeah, we were reading that in your resume. But something really set the fire with you in paleontology. So you ended up getting a science degree or both science and literature at
I got
Berkeley?
Both.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was very much interested in a whole lot of things. And I had great professors in both departments. But I ended up going to grad school in biology under the impression that it would be easier to find employment as a biologist.
Than a comparative literature major?
Yes,
I see. Myreen, what you're saying, if I'm following what you, the voice within you really was within science, and you were curious about the natural world?
Yeah, I think that was part of it, that that science gave me questions that I realized needed exploring. And and sure, not necessarily exploring by me, but generally there were still questions out there. And certainly there are also questions in literature, but I felt more equipped to pursue, or I felt like I could carve a better niche for myself in science.
So somewhere in there, pardon the pun, the dog thing bit you. Right? There's a little segue there, but...
Wait, is it dogs or is it just basic fossil mammalian carnivores?
Well, carnivora, but you're kind of a dog person. But yeah, explain carnivora and dogs to us, if you would, please.
Yeah, of course. But before that, I wanted to make another allusion, which is I also like saying that, you know, just as animals got stuck in the tar pits, I got stuck as well.
Well, you know, I think you get near the tar pits. People do get literally stuck in it mentally. You know, it's such a fascinating thing. So
I think that's the case for a lot of other people as well. I think that a lot of people want to come, study tar pits fossils. At that time, for my master's degree, I thought about studying the large carnivores at the tar pit. So
which one though? But which one? When, I know large carnivores encompasses everything, the short-faced bear, the smilodon.
Yeah, all of them.
All of them. There wasn't anyone in particular that...
Not anyone in particular, which actually may have been a bit problematic for a master's thesis because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work for a single person to do.
What were you doing in that paper? You were looking at all the large carnivores and seeing if being carnivorous was a hindrance through time?
Yeah, so I was looking at the large carnivores, including the dire wolf and the saber-toothed cat, American lion, short-faced bear. And I was also looking at some of the smaller ones, like bobcat, mountain lion, for example. And my question was, first of all, I was intrigued by how many of them there were and how few of them there are now in modern ecosystems here, at least here in North America. My main question is why? And also, how did those large carnivores coexist without just automatically excluding each other?
Can I offer a real simple solution? I'm a non-scientist. With such large megafauna, that's a lot of meat to eat.
That is.
Doesn't it make sense? You'd have a diversity of carnivores and filling every niche.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Yes. There were a lot of large carnivores, yes, but there were also a lot of large herbivores, and you know,
a lot of
coming
things on the menu.
From...
Yes, many things on the menu.
Exactly. So as a master's student, I was curious about what do we know about their diets, and how can we differentiate these diets from each other, and do they overlap in the things that they ate?
God, I've got a million questions here. So the bones at La Brea are pretty much jumbled. There's very few articulated skeletons because the tar is a malleable sediment. It's always moving. And the way you can infer diet is through, obviously, the anatomical structures such as teeth and claws. But are there coprolites? How would you know that a smilodon, a saber-toothed cat, primarily ate bison or camel or woolly mammoth. And wait, Ray is raising his hand.
Isotopes? Isotopes?
Whoa, did you know
histology?
That?
You mean bone histology?
No, isotopes and histology, right? What's the difference?
Yes. Yes, so both of those. So,
Ray for the win.
Yeah, so those are certainly two of the tools that we could use to infer diet. So going back to David's question about coprolites, to my knowledge, we have not found coprolites of the large carnivores at the tar pits. We have found coprolites of the little guys. So,
and recently, just found recently the rat poo or whatever. Rodent poo. And they thought it was contemporary. They found it was like 30,000 years old, something like that.
For the listening audience, a coprolite is fossilized poop. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Yes, thank you, Ray. Fossilized poop. So at the tar pits, we have found just this fossilized wood rat poop. And it's really cool. It has some, you know, plant material in it as well that our paleobotany curator, Regan Dunn, who was on the show earlier.
Oh, Regan, that's right.
Yeah, so I know that she's interested in continuing that work, I think. Anyway, so coprolites would be a surefire way for us to, you know, say, oh, this bone was in that animal's poop. This animal must have eaten that one, you know.
How do you know what poop came from what animal? That's the other thing. I mean, you know, herbivore and carnivore coprolites are different, obviously. But how do you know that? Well, that's canid. That's felae. How do you say felae?
Felid.
Feline, cat or dog, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a shape and a size that are hints, right?
Yes, okay. There is a shape and a size, and you know, oh, does it happen in like a series of pellets, or right. Like is there a terminal pellet, and what is its shape?
So how are the carnivores? How do we know what they ate?
Okay, so Ray brought up isotopes. So this is basically. This is a chemical analysis, right? A biogeochemical analysis specifically. So isotopes rely on the premise of you are what you eat. And basically this means that, you know, if I eat a lot of, for example, for lunch, I just had like fish ceviche, right? So fish are going to have a different geochemical or chemical signal than, for example, if I had eaten like a salad for lunch that was mostly leaves, for example. And all of that, all of those chemicals in the stuff that I eat get deposited in every tissue of my body. May that be in my hair or in my teeth or in my bones. So taking that to the fossil record, it is possible for us to take a bone or even a tooth from an animal. So for example, from a dire wolf and say, oh, okay, this... You know, let's sample carbon and nitrogen from this animal's bones specifically. And, it has this signature. You know, this is the parts per mil value of this animal in terms of its carbon content and its nitrogen content. And that value matches up with this, you know, this value of whatever, horse or bison. Oh, it must have eaten... Therefore, horse or bison.
Oh, you could get down to specific animals.
It depends. So
I thought it'd just be, oh well, it's a meat eater or a herbivore, but you could actually say short-faced bears ate camels or bison.
If you know already the players in your community, if your herbivores, for example, do not overlap in their isotopic composition, then you might be able to trace
them.
Got it. But if all the herbivores ate grass, then, right. You know, that might not be as possible.
Would you be able to parse out that maybe saber-toothed cats being more of an ambush predator are going to wait for the bigger guys, and maybe there's more mammoth isotopes in them, they could take them down, but a dire wolf is going to take down buffalo. Well, I guess they're both eating grass, though. But can you parse that? Let me do...
Yeah.
I got my question.
Then I'm going to throw a big wrench
all right,
in this
okay,
whole
you
discussion.
Will. Yeah. As you often do.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And okay, there are some ideas these days. we need to do more ground truthing of what different isotopes from different sources mean. As far as I'm aware at the moment, we get slightly different pictures from when we sample for isotopes from bone collagen, for example, versus isotopes from tooth enamel. Yeah, there needs to be more work done just to figure out, like, okay, so the bone isotopes say that, you know, for example, saber-toothed cat and dire wolf were overlapping in their diet, but maybe the enamel isotopes don't say that. So what could be the issue there? And is it that, you know, is it because maybe saber-toothed cats were like hunting in a different environment or not? So there are definitely ideas these days saying, oh, they differ in these particular isotopes, so they must, you know, saber-toothed must have been on the plains and dire wolf must have been in the forest, but then other isotopes don't say that as much, so we need to figure out.
Right. So it's tantalizing. It's possible we're not there yet, I guess, is what you're saying. Here comes that wrench. Here comes the wrench.
Here comes that wrench. Okay, what percentage of animals in the La Brea collection are just bones that animals died and, you know, were buried through sediment? And what percentage were stuck in the tar and died through that violence of being alive and being preyed upon and then being preyed upon, and the cat comes on the mammoth and the bird goes on the cat and the dire wolf goes on all of them? What percentage are natural death collections of bones and what percentage are stuck in the pits?
So that is a very traumatic scenario that you have just painted, Dave. So the short answer is that we're not sure. We are developing a more nuanced picture now of how animals became trapped.
Okay, well, here's my wrench, though. My wrench is that you have a place in Southern California where all these animals are entombed in tar. So that is not a natural... It's not a natural collection of the Southern California basin. That is a place where it had high mortality, high preservation, and possibly most of those animals died because they got stuck.
Mm-hmm.
All the data that comes from La Brea is specialized and highly focused and might not represent the natural environment 20 miles away.
Absolutely. Okay, sorry. So the wrench part of that was that...
the wrench part of it is that when this is such a specialized place and a specialized collection and maybe not representational of the Pleistocene,
mm-hmm.
20 miles away or 100 miles away, Bakersfield or San Diego.
Pleistocene. Thank you.
Thank you. I always do that. Pleistocene.
Try to keep you honest, Dave. Go ahead with your wrench.
You're not getting real, you're getting twisted data. It's twisted data.
Well, hence
how do we know that all the Smilodons don't normally eat mammoth, but you go and you check out their histology, oh, they've been eating mammoth, but no, that was because there was a mammoth stuck and they saw that opportunity. That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so there are at least I have multiple answers to your question, or multiple angles at which to approach it.
Great.
So first, Rancho La Brea, or the La Brea Tar Pits, is not the only asphaltic locality that we have in California from the Pleistocene. So we have a couple others. There are, for example, the McKittrick asphalt seeps over by Buttonwillow in Kern County. And there's also Maricopa around, also in that general region. And so those two other sites are understudied at the moment.
Are those asphaltic sites, though?
They are also asphaltic
sites. Well, I'm talking about non-asphaltic, where animals don't get stuck. For example, there's a new one that they found up by Chico.
Right. So is that also Pleistocene?
Could be Miocene. I think it's older.
The Miocene. Yeah.
Okay.
So a different depositional scenario.
Yeah. So I think I actually have, if it's the Meriton Formation up there, then I have studied fossils from there as well. And would be happy to chat about that after, you know, maybe later on. But, so going back to your original question, which is, you know, okay, so you had asked how representative could this be of a Pleistocene ecosystem, considering that it's asphaltic and, you know, animals were getting stuck and, you know, maybe they wouldn't have gotten preserved if they had not gotten stuck. Okay, so there is this idea, maybe the large carnivores at the tar pits got stuck because maybe they were, you know, somehow weakened by something, or you know, they saw easy prey, or maybe they were like I got a question yesterday, for example, oh, were these like maybe naive animals who had gotten stuck?
Naive? Dumb. They were just dumb. The dumb ones got stuck. All right.
You can't tell there's tar there because water floats above the tar. You can't see that when you're going for a drink.
Yeah, sometimes. Also, there's other stuff that we can get into there about, you know, water flowing on top or not. So if it's, you know, maybe animals, maybe predators that were getting hurt, that were already injured, maybe they just saw easy prey and went after that easy prey. Right. So that's one idea. However, I have done work on the pathology collection that we have here at the Tar Pits. So this is an entire collection that is separate from most of the other specimens that we have. And this is a collection of bones from mainly saber-toothed cats and dire wolves, also some other animals. But these bones have pathologies on them, or lesions on the skeleton, that most of which are traumatic or sustained from, most likely from hunting or some other active behavior.
A hunting injury, right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing is, the prevalence of these injuries is still pretty low. So it's about, you know, only about 3% of animals had these, of the saber-toothed cats and dire wolves at least, had sustained injuries.
But what percentage of herbivores have carnivore pathology, you know, teeth marks, bite marks, crushed bones?
Yeah, I don't think we have very many. I haven't looked at them personally, but yeah, I don't recall there being much direct evidence.
So the cat jumping on the mammoth and the bird jumping on the cat and the rat jumping on the bird, that deposition is a fallacy or very uncommon?
It's possible. I know more about possibly the cat jumping on the mammoth, but then the like scavenging bird, you know, then jumping on the remains of the cat and the mammoth. I think that's possible, but we need more work done on the birds.
The big popcorn ball of predators. So it just keeps getting more and more and more. But I'm going to take it back to dogs. You know, I've looked through you have a really great what. There's a really great website. You have a really great website, and I love that you have a Spotify dog playlist. I've even contributed to your playlist. Did you update that a little bit?
I forgot. Oh, yeah, I haven't. I meant to. I'm sorry. I know.
Well, I did.
Well, you know what? You can find a link to her Spotify playlist on this episode.
And we'll update it before that. My read, did dogs evolve in North America? And once upon a time, North America was a dog paradise. There was great diversity of dogs, dogs beyond our imagination. Did they start out in North America, or where do dogs come from?
Yes, dogs did start out in North America.
They did. Wow.
Yeah, and that's one quiz question that I like to use it as an icebreaker in some of my talks, you know, just, which continent do you think dogs came from? And people have seven options for the seven continents. And people typically answer with Africa or Asia.
Yeah.
Which I think
that's what I would have said.
Huh. Right. And I think that's very interesting because it reflects our modern ideas about where biodiversity is. Mm. And, you know, South America, Africa, Asia, like, yes, we recognize those as current hotspots of biodiversity. But 40 million years ago, which is when the first dog fossils started appearing, or North America was a very different place. And it was, yeah, so the dogs back then, too, were also just different. They were smaller. They were more omnivorous. So today we have wolves and coyotes and foxes. Like, those are our three main types of dogs. by dog also. I feel like I need to clarify by dog. I, as a paleontologist, being canidae, so the entire right. dog family, not just domestic dogs, but also right. Their ancestors. So yeah, today our main dogs here in North America, apart from domestic dogs, are wolves and coyotes and foxes. But all of those are only distantly related to a lot of the fossil dogs that we have from about 40 million years ago onwards.
So who's the mother of all dogs, wolves, and foxes?
The mother. Well, I can talk about the ancestral species.
There are three main groups. There were three big families, right?
Yes, there were three.
Hesperocyonidae.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
three Orophaginae and Caninae. How do you say
Canidae.
That?
Yeah, exactly. So three subfamilies of dog, including fossils. So you got that right. The earliest species that we know of is Hesperocyon gregarius. So that's where the name Hesperocyoninae comes from, because Hesperocyon, you know, was like the landmark species for this subfamily. So Hesperocyoninae appeared about, you know, it was the earliest subfamily, and it appeared from about 40 million years ago, went extinct about 15 million years ago. And then Borophaginae was the subfamily that originated after that. So Borophaginae and Hesperocyoninae overlapped a lot, actually. And so Borophaginae arose pretty early on as well. Actually, all three subfamilies arose pretty early.
Well, let's just back up a little bit. We have three families of dogs. There's great diversity in North America. Three families were the Canidae, which our modern-day dogs belong to, the Hespero. I'm going to leave it to you. I'm garbling
it. Yeah, sure.
Canidae is the top of the tree. Then there's the three underneath.
Two underneath.
Yeah. Hesperocyanidae, Borophaginae. Why don't they just call them like doggy, little doggy fox-like and weasel-like? Why don't we?
Well, actually, the Borophaginae are the bone-crushing dogs known commonly. How about mm-hmm. The earliest group that you were talking about, the Hesperocyonidae? Yeah. Is there mm-hmm. a common name for them?
Not really. So they look like small dogs. I mean, there's a variety. There's a variety. So, okay, I just want to clarify for everyone. So
okay.
the dog family in general is called Canidae. So the day part, D-A-E, that signifies the family level. And then in the dog family, Canidae, there are three subfamilies. So most ancestral is Hesperocyoninae, and the nae part of that signifies subfamily level.
Ah.
Nae is a N-A-E. First, we have Hesperocyoninae, and these animals, when they started out, they looked very much like raccoons or omnivores. They were relatively small to medium-sized.
Slender
and
bodies.
Yeah, a bit of a slender body, but then they started to evolve. They started to develop these large-bodied members. Later on, these large-bodied members included the genus Enhydrocyon, which had several species, especially in the John Day fossil beds of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Where Ray just was.
I was down there a few weeks ago.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah,
yeah, it's what an amazing sight.
Lovely
That's one
place.
Of my favorite places. Yeah, so so that's Hesperocyoninae. And then there's Borophaginae, mm-hmm. which overlapped a lot with Hesperocyoninae. Borophaginae arose also around 40 million years or close to that, between 40 and 35, and went extinct about 2 million years ago. And Borophaginae, so boro just means, you know, something hard or tough. So these are the tough-eating dogs or bone-cracking dogs. And I understand you had someone earlier in this series.
Amy Atwater studied them.
All right,
in San Diego.
Yeah, yeah. So Amy Atwater spoke about bone crushing dogs, and these are those. However, Borophaginae, even though their name means like bone or, you know, or tough eating, that's not all they did. So like Hesperocyoninae, they also originated as smaller bodied, relatively omnivorous forms. And actually, some of the species in this subfamily evolved into these even smaller and almost probably herbivorous.
Yeah, I counted 14 species of the boar vaginus.
Maybe you're thinking about Borophagus, and that is the
one genus.
Yeah, so...
I get so confused with genus species.
It's half of what we talk about in this show, trying to get Dave to understand that. But
went to Wikipedia. This is great. You go to Wikipedia and you type in, and you get these trees, and each tree has a link, and you can link and look at a photo You can look at a drawing or the skeleton of any of these, and there are a multitude to dive into.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the genus Borophagus, those are definitely large, definitely bone cracking. And I think they've, you know, well, these animals, we don't have them anymore. And we don't really have bone crackers anymore either. The closest we have are hyenas. But then we don't have those in North America anymore either. So the fact that there were animals like that, distantly related, because hyenas are
Actually more cats.
Exactly.
Hyenas are mind-blowing,
I know, I first learned that. I was just,
hyenas are more cat-like than
dog-like? No, they're on the cat family tree, dude. I've sent you an image that had that all charted
Let's
out.
See here, Carnivora mammala. I'm looking, by the way, Ray has the most amazing tree. It's a literal tree with these giant leaves. And we have bear, let's see, dogs, wolves, bear dogs, pandas, oyster bear,
go down
bears.
The tree and see the split between the dogs and the cats. They didn't get along early on. They split.
Yeah.
But actually, that brings me up back to, so is Episcion a bone-crushing dog? Episcion?
Yeah, Episcion is also a bone-crushing dog.
So that's within that group. Enough. And they are, that was maybe technically the biggest, baddest dog of all time?
Mm-hmm. Yep,
how big?
Yep.
How big?
It's big enough that I've seen reconstructions of Episcion right next to a Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, not quite that size, but it was large enough.
You mean black bear or grizzly bear size or what?
Probably not that big also, but still bigger than a lot of the dogs that we have today. Right. So think about the biggest dogs that we have today, for example.
But here's my question. Where do dogs and bear dogs diverge, and what is the difference? Because the bear dogs had a great deal of diversity too, and many of them were tiny, but many were huge. Amphicyon?
Amphicyon was one of them.
Yeah. So where do they, and what's the difference between these bone-crushing dogs, and where's that split? What's the distinct thing between bear dogs and these bone-crushing dogs, or dogs in general?
So a lot of the evidence for, you know, how to classify, for example, cats versus dogs or dogs versus bear dogs, a lot of the evidence for that is skeletal and has to do with structures of the skull, specifically of the inner ear. So I personally have not done that work, but people like Bob Hunt at Nebraska, for example, has done a lot of work on bear dogs. Meanwhile, someone I've worked with closely at the Natural History Museum of LA County here, Xiaoming Wang. So he has done a lot of the work on dogs. Yeah, for questions about exactly how the ear part of the skull is structured and how that differs between dogs and bear dogs.
Wow, is that subtle? Huh, wow.
Doesn't all canidae ear structure have an extra piece of bone in the middle ear, and that's what separates them from all other?
Yeah. So that's part of it. But what I'm not sure of is that a canidae specific thing, or is that a caniform specific thing? Because caniforms include the bear dogs.
Right. Well,
yeah.
As usual, our minds are reeling. There's a lot of information here. Wow. But here's a real basic question, though. When do dogs and wolves split? I know it's not, you know, an area of your specialty, but you must know people that know.
Before we get to that, though, because that's going to be leading to what I want to ask, is cats and dogs came from a common ancestor?
Way back when.
Way back when.
All mammals. Yeah, all mammals at the end of the Cretaceous. We're all mammals.
No, but on the carnivora tree, there's splitting that happens, and that's early on.
Okay, so cats and dogs are kind of related.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, eventually at some point.
Okay, and then your question, Ray.
My question is farther up, way farther up the tree and off down the dog branch, all right? The Canidae, the Canaanite branch, right? If I'm following Marina correctly. When do we know, can we see in the fossil record where dogs and wolves split? And that's still the latest thinking is that dogs are basically domesticated wolves.
Yes, so that's still what we know, that dogs are domesticated from wolves. And they're still, you know, my impression of it, my understanding of it is that there's still a lot of active research being done on this, ranging from, you know, morphometric work. So looking at the shape of some early, some specimens, for example, found at archaeological sites. There have been studies asking, oh, are these wolves or are these dogs, you know, domestic dogs? And those tend to be thousands of years old, tens of thousands of years old. And there are also studies, of course, of, you know, involving genetic work, figuring out like, oh.
Sorry, let me get this straight. So dogs and wolves come from a common ancestor or dogs come from wolves? I thought a paper came out just recently saying that dogs did not descend from wolves, that they share a common ancestor.
Yeah, so I mean, both kind of make sense in the from the perspective that, well, there probably isn't a single wolf lineage that gave rise to the modern domestic dog, right? And so, it's probably not that a single, you know, we probably cannot trace domestic dogs to a single wolf ancestor per se. There's also the likelihood that this domestication process may have been happening, not just in one instance.
Actually, you found a domestic dog in La Brea, right? There is a couple in the collection there. So that's fascinating. Well, I was going to say, I think that the process of evolution, and many of our guests have talked about this too, there's branching, but then there's also kind of the branch is pretty tangled, and there's that process of the dogs, the domestic dogs splitting off from wolves, the common ancestor. There's a group, and then maybe that group interbreeds, and they come back in. And evolution, I think we're beginning to see it's not so simple that there's some. And then
it's
there's
not a
then
tree,
there's
a it's
diversion.
A vine.
It's a it's vine a, that sometimes winds and winds. Then there's a split, and then there's it's not that simple.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, it's like a tangled bank, right?
Yeah.
Or it's rather than a tree, it might be. A really tangled bush, right? So yes, we do have a single domestic dog fossil at
one.
The tar pits.
Wow.
Yeah, one at the moment.
How old?
About 3,000 years old.
1973.
Yeah, so it is a fossil. It is thousands of years old, specifically 3,000 years old. So that's pretty young. And I personally did not find this dog fossil. This dog fossil.
How do you know they're
was...
domesticated? They didn't have a collar.
Yeah, so.
You mean a Native American lost their dog in the tar pit?
It's possible. I mean, you know, people get, I mean, we have squirrels like getting trapped these days. So just some traits of it, you know, look like domestic dog. It looks pretty, okay. So at the tar pits, we also have foxes, gray fox in particular. And this clearly looks like a dog. It did not look like a fox. It also did not look like a coyote. And, yeah, so it there were, wow. And it definitely was not the size of a dire wolf, not the size of a gray wolf. And it was not, you know, just a wolf pup or anything. So just, yeah, process of elimination, you know, by people who came before me here at the carpets. Yes, Ray.
Did you give it a name?
Oh, man.
Did they call it? Because I know you've named, you know, there's Zed, the big elephant, the big Colombian mammoth that's out there.
Yeah.
Nobody named the dog?
All right.
I
there's
know,
a, con- a contest for when the museum reopens.
You're right. We do. We have named other things at the museum. So, for example, we have a mountain lion skull that we've named Pebbles. And, you know, but we have not named this domestic dog, probably because it, you know, it was excavated before we started naming things. But I think that is a fantastic idea for
Outreach.
Yeah, for outreach for our museum, you know, reopening.
Is it just especially... a skull, or do you have more of that one domestic dog?
It is. There are some other post-crania as well. These are, you know, non-skull parts. But yeah, it is mostly just the skull. And it's a broken skull. Oh. You can actually see. So there's this cup of bone that is inside our skulls and also inside this dog's skull. This cup of bone is called the cribriform plate. It sits between the olfactory lobe of your brain and the rest of your nose. So this dog has its skull broken in just the right place that you can see that it has a fully intact cribriform plate, which is incredible.
What does that mean, though? Why? What? So?
So, I think it would be exciting to be able to study the cribriform plate of this dog, because the shape of that plate and the size of it can be reflective of how well it's spelled. And this is a lot of this work on this particular bone has been done by my lab that I did my graduate studies in at UCLA, specifically by my colleague, Deborah Bird. So, yeah. Bird studied this bone in a lot of other mammalian carnivores and found relationships between the size and shape of the bone and also...
the ability to... the olfactory intensity.
Yeah, the ability to smell.
Wow.
So I think that would be super cool to be able to study in this particular dog fossil. How does that compare to other...
A Great Dane or a dire wolf.
Well, actually...
Exactly.
Before we leave the idea of naming this tar pit pooch, how big is it? Is it a big dog or is it a little dog?
It's a smaller dog. I mean, it's not a chihuahua.
All right, so it's a small dog. All right, curious.
I'd say it's a Jack Terrier. yeah, maybe a small to medium-sized dog, I would say.
And it's an adult.
Yes.
So at the height of dog diversity in North America, how many species were there?
Okay, so this there were about 25 different species, and this was about 29 million years ago.
And how many are left today?
In North America, there are about 8 today.
Oh, that's right. So dog, gray wolf, coyote.
And a bunch of foxes.
Foxes, right.
Actually not even counting domestic dog in that.
Yeah, well, that's human mistakes.
So, Maureen, does that include, that's 29, 30-ish species way back there. Is that different genera?
Yes, also different genera.
So how many genera were there?
That's, oh, man.
So I'm talking to a scientist. I'm throwing this at you.
I know, yeah. I would say probably at least 10 genera, probably more than that, probably more like 15. But, yeah, it's the number of species that stands out to me because... genera are kind of
general.
Yeah. Well, they're variations on a theme, I guess. Though, yeah. I look at them that way. And today's how many genera are in North America?
Okay, so there's Canis, and there's lupus and Latrans. Those are the gray wolf and coyote. And then there's Eurocyon, which is the gray fox, and also the
Channel Island.
Exactly, Channel Islands fox. Those are both Eurocyon. And then we have Vulpes, that's the red fox.
Well, Dave and I are talking about genus and species, genus being more general, species being more specific. But I look at general as like, you know, there's the Pacific salmon, you know, we've got 6 species and we found out that there's actually a few more that are within the genus. But in the Canis world today, there's 6 species in the genus Canis: dogs, wolves, coyotes, the golden wolf, and there's the Ethiopian wolf, and there's a jackal.
Jackal.
And those are all variations on basically, you know, and the domestic dog, you know, those are variations on what we commonly think of as dogs, which is, there's a lot of diversity there. So just, it's pretty amazing.
Well, they're filling all kinds of ecological niches is what they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And also they're filling these niches all around the globe, right? Like the golden wolf, for example, like those are not in North America.
Right.
It's only Canidae that got to migrate all around the world.
Right. Well, it's still kind of a dog's world, I guess, you know.
What's the coolest fossil that has blown you away in your lifetime as a paleontologist?
Well, our
pathology... It could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be at the La Brea Tar Pits.
Oh, okay. I think I'm going to answer with a tar pits fossil anyway. Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of really cool fossils elsewhere. We are lucky at the Tar Pits to have a pathology collection, and I've mentioned it earlier in this chat. This was a pathological pelvis or hip bone from a saber-toothed cat. For almost 100 years, what people thought about this this fossil, thanks to, you know, the work by Moody and Chris Shaw, Fred Heald, and others, the impression that we had of this particular pathology was that, oh, this animal was hunting and it got hurt because hunting is a very dangerous activity. It got hurt and, you know, this injury did not heal properly and got infected. And that's why we have this really gnarly bone that is preserved in our collections today. But
and the drum roll. So what is it really?
This is active work on my end. People at the Tar Pits and I have collaborated with orthopedic surgeons from Cedars-Sinai who have brought this, you know, kind of new technology called computed tomography or CT, which you may have heard
of. CT, yeah, all right.
Yeah, three-dimensional scanning. Can I guess what it is?
What is it? What do you think, Dave?
I'm guessing it's either a disease or a birth defect.
Yeah, it actually is a birth defect. So this saber-toothed cat has this condition called
clickety hip.
Yeah, hip dysplasia, which is pretty common in our living, you know, domestic dogs and also domestic cats.
My cousin's daughter had a clickety hip.
Oh, my goodness.
She was in a cast where the legs are stationary.
Wow.
So you cat scanned the cat.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes, indeed.
The cat came back.
Wow.
So as
the very next day.
Cool. Here we go, Myreen. A tough question. Actually, it's a fun question. If you could go back to any period in time, any epic epoch, any favorite paleo period, when would it be and what would you want to see?
Oh, man. Okay.
Time travel. What do you want to see?
Time travel. I would love to see some bone-cracking dogs. And so, and I don't mean like hyenas, right? I mean, they're not dogs. But so I have done some work on the dogs from this one locality called, it's the Marin Formation in Central California. It's in this region that our collaborators found fossilized poops from a bone-cracking dog. And through the power of math, I was able to... measure there was bone in these fossilized poops, which is incredible. And one of those bone fragments really happened to be, it looked like part of a rib of a larger herbivore. Mm. So we were able to, measure that bone fragment. And then I went into the collections of the Natural History Museum here and measured a whole lot of ribs from those.
What do you think it was?
Yeah, we could not identify the bone to species, what we did find was that it was likely from an herbivore that was larger than the bone-cracking dog in question, or that whose poop it was, which is a cool result in itself, because this species of bone-cracking dog is Barophagus parvus. And it's like a medium-sized bone-cracking dog. It's large, absolutely, compared to other dogs.
So they hunt in groups or packs.
Yes, that is part of what we thought.
You would infer.
Yeah, what we would infer, because for this dog to have been able to take down an herbivore larger than itself. Unless it was scavenging.
If this Barophagus was out chasing it down... In your mind's eye, what do you see it taken down? Come on, just conjecture now.
Something larger than a deer, I would say.
Something cool and prehistoric?
Yeah, like a prehistoric, not quite a moose-sized thing, but are you thinking of something that we absolutely don't have today?
Well, I don't know.
Of course, yeah, you're back in time. There, everything's extinct.
Yeah, it's taken down a little baby mastodon. It's taken down.
Yeah, like a little dino. Yeah, a gomphotheater, a dino theater, yeah. Or something like that. Yeah, well, this is why I want to time travel, though, because that's something that I would be able to see if I could time travel.
I'm leading the witness. I'm trying to put creatures into your time travel.
Still, that's thank good. You. That would be great. A crunching, giant, bone-killing, bone-crushing
I can
dog.
Hear David's sound effects already.
Yeah. Myrene, I'd like to think I see the world factually because I'm always reading up on not just, paleontology, but biology, archaeology, history, astronomy, anything with an ology. So I'd like to think that my world is based in fact. So my question is, what's the best way to promote fact-based truths in science at the same time some social media and political news outlets promote the opposite, lies and misinformation?
Yeah, that is such a deep question. So
there is no simple answer, but give me some advice to a non-scientist.
Right. I think actually maybe counterintuitively, I think that getting people to understand facts involves getting them to understand the uncertainties behind the facts. So, okay, from a scientific perspective, we know what we know based on the methods that we have at that time based on the specimens that we have at that time, right? But then it's always possible to collect new evidence. And, in the case of this pathological hip from the saber tooth that I mentioned, now we have new technology that we've been able to apply to this very old specimen. And so through that, we have a better understanding of
how
this
animal. Well, you rewrote its history. Based on new factual information from new technology.
We have good ideas. We might have hypotheses that need testing. And then we get a conclusion from that study. But that doesn't mean that the book needs to be closed right then and there. Because some new evidence might come along or some new methods might come along that would help us develop a better understanding of that particular problem. So I think just getting the public to understand that I think in school we are like fed facts, but one of the things that
I think we're fed facts without context.
Yeah, rather than saying, "Oh, I guess that fact was wrong," it's more like, oh, "Okay, we just have new methods, new evidence to bring to bear on that."
You test the evidence.
Exactly. You test hypotheses.
Test the hypothesis. Mm-hmm. Well, so I've really enjoyed this. We jump all over the place. We go where we go. But thank you for joining us on our little joyride of carnivores today. And it's kind of making me hungry, too.
And I love that word, bone-cracking. Bone-cracking dog. Wow.
Yeah, or bone-crushing.
Bone-crushing, bone-cracking. Yeah, yeah.
Bone crushing sounds more metal, so.
Myrene, that was so awesome. Thank you so much. And I know more about dogs and the evolution of these canine critters.
Glad to help. This was really fun. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And I will update my dog playlist
right
after this.
Yeah, remember. All right,
thank you, Ray.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Wow, bear dogs, dogs, wolves, jackals, dogs.
Carnivores, all in that tree there. So yeah, carnivora, tar pits, things dying, things eating stuff. And then I like the cat scan cat.
Yeah, that sounds like a song.
Cat scan cat. But what I learned, my takeaway from this was that, North America has got it going on. We are not only the place where horses and camels evolved, we are the homeland of dogs. Dogs came from here, man.
Yeah, yeah. I went down a very strange rabbit hole on social media that claimed that horses had been here, that the Spanish didn't introduce them. And I started reading this whole thing.
Well, horses evolved here, but then they went extinct after they'd left over the land bridge.
This was a rabbit hole that said they never left, that the Native Americans had domesticated them, they had never got extinct here, and that it's wrong that the Spanish had reintroduced them back in Florida. And then there was a comment that said, dude, this is all poppycock. And I went, oh my God, I'm reading one of those posts that was all bull.
Well, there has been. I have met people and credible people, and I've discussed this and with them.
Is there truth to this rumor?
I think most paleontologists don't think. Most paleontologists think they went extinct here in North America for a period.
Right. And were reintroduced by Columbus and then Cortez.
But there is,
we went down this road on another previous episode.
Yes, we did. But there's been pushback from it. But I think still the majority think they went extinct. But there's some holdouts. So that's what it's not so much. It's not like Sasquatch, for instance. which I ain't gonna go down that one.
Well, just so you know, a friend of mine, he left Ketchikan and he's now running a Sasquatch adventure tour.
Right on, man. More power to him. I bet you they keep touring and touring because they're not seeing.
I'll bet they're making so much money. Look, it's almost there. Huh? I almost saw it.
Yeah.
Wait, did you hear that? No, that's not an elk bugle. That's Sasquatch.
Did you see that broken tree limb? That was a Sasquatch.
Yeah. Oh, my God, Ray. I want to stick to science. I want to stick to science. You know what I loved? When Myrene didn't know the answer, she said she didn't know. Or she said, you know, we're working on that. And that's what's great about science. Science is not exact.
I think we've noticed that with all of our scientific guests, our scientist friends that have been on. And if they're not really comfortable with an answer, they're not going to BS us. You know, they're going to tell us what they know.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's great. If you like our show, please tell your friends. Please rate us on iTunes and Facebook and all that stuff.
Or send us an email saying, great job. And we've been answering those. We answer the emails that we get.
Got some great, great complimentary emails. And if there's something you don't like, let us know in an email. Ray, you don't like that, do you?
Nah. Nah, I can't handle it. I'm very sensitive.
Well,
I think you know that.
You've
made me cry a few times, Dave. But
I know I have.
I'm getting a tougher skin, but not really. So.
Well, you know what? I'm coming to Ketchikan real soon, and I can't wait. So I'll see you in person.
It'll be
good
to hang.
You cry in person, Ray.
Be good to hang in person, man. We'll have some sort of adventure. We shall do something. But, hey, man, in the meantime, I'm got to go down the hill and talk to some museum folks and, go check at the Life at the Soho Coho on the creek.
I'm going to begin continuing the 20-hour edit of the last episode that I'm putting all the sound effects. I will.
Have fun. I know you do. You can tell. People dig it. So,
all right, Ray. Signing off from Ojai, California, where it's been so windy that the trees have lost all their leaves and it's still spring.
Oh, how nice. Are you going to get rain sometime?
Nope. We are screwed.
More about that later. But it's supposed to rain here tonight. We've had a great stretch of weather, and then it's going to be sunny again. So I'm down the hill. See you later, dude.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for being a paleo nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know each episode is paired with pictures and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a paleo nerd for a long, long time.
I'm a paleo nerd. Don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd.